John Lennon, 1980, The Last Days in the Life is the book. Kenneth Womack, the author, joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Kenneth, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great. How are things in the Windy City?
They're not as windy as they will be in a few months. It's still nice out. I had a glorious walk over here. It's funny. We've had so much unrest in the world this year and such craziness, but a beautiful fall evening before the sun sets in Chicago is still a glorious thing. So thanks for asking. Things are well here in Chicago. Let's talk a little bit about John Lennon. 40 years later, it's going to be, which is insane. And so I'm going to be 50 in another year or so. And so I was only about to turn nine when John Lennon passed. So I know the Beatles, of course, as anybody does when you listen to the music and it becomes part of the culture, even if you weren't alive for it when it happened. But I don't know the stories of John Lennon very well and his days with Yoko Ono. And it's such an amazing story. I was reading your book for a lot of the day today. And if you don't know the Beatles, you know the Beatles and you know Yoko and you either love or hate Yoko, but you don't know the complexity of that relationship, do we?
No, we don't. I really spent a lot of time making sure she got her due in this new book. I really felt like people need to rethink her. And after all, she was John's choice, right? For his life partner.
Yeah. And that wasn't always a simple thing, was it? I mean, they really had their ups and downs, and they really were a new age couple, weren't they?
They really were, and it was one of the many, many ways in which they were ahead of the curve, right? They had an understood breakup in the early part of the 70s and got back together in the early months of 1975, and they were way ahead of their times, but, you know, when you also study that relationship, you also see that it has the same kind of rhythms and ebbs of all relationships, right? Where there are times when they're really working well together and other times when they're not. And I would imagine for Yoko especially, it's meaningful to her that they did seem to have some really good moments there in those last several months where they were lockstep with this passion and this great new project.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting kind of that you describe it as it has its ups and downs like any relationship. What most relationships that I'm aware of don't have is one spouse encouraging the other to have an affair with somebody else to sort of keep things happy and copacetic, which is what I believe I sort of read.
It is what you read, but, you know, of course, she was finding John's behavior, particularly when she was trying to work on an album, to be volatile and she had felt shamed by him a couple of times. So it's kind of understanding that she wanted to be away from him, but she didn't want to break up with him. So I guess that's where it becomes unconventional.
Yeah, for sure. Tell me a little bit, because you mentioned Yoko gets her due, and of course we won't spend most of the time talking about Yoko, but you mentioned Yoko is working on an album. Now, you're with John Lennon, so everything you do is going to be somewhat tinged with the aura of John Lennon, and it's either blessed by John Lennon or cursed by John Lennon. How do we evaluate her as an artist? Because it's easy to dismiss and say, well, she was with John Lennon, otherwise she's not making albums. Is that not true at all? Was she just an avant-garde artist who, you know, really inspired John Lennon, and there is a lot of credibility to her artistry?
I do think that when you take a separate look at what she was doing in the 60s, even prior to meeting John Lennon, you know, she had established a reputation as a performance artist. And I've been to some of her shows, and she clearly was ahead of the curve in terms of her own brand of art at a time when that art wasn't as readily accepted, right? But our other problem, if you want to think about her as a musician, and her one album, by the way, Approximately Infinite Universe is very much worth a listen. It's one of her solo records. But I say this, it's before John is murdered. It's several years before, in fact. I don't know that because of the way their story ends very abruptly, at least in the physical sense, right? On December 8th, 1980, we can never really evaluate, and probably not in our own time, the quality of her work, because really everything from that moment has this shadow of this assassination. I was thinking about this today, you know, for many people, Double Fantasy which only existed for 3 weeks flat when John was murdered as a public artifact. You know, Double Fantasy for many people is absolutely tinged with that experience. Most people hadn't heard it before the murder. The same thing could be said about the wonderful song they were working on and completing the night he was killed, Walking on Thin Ice. I remember getting it in January 1981 and thinking, even at that age, wow, I wish I could have heard this without this other business in my head, right? About assassination and what happened, because I could never take that song on its own merits. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine how that. Now, talk to me a little bit about what Lennon left behind, because I've gotten about a third of the way through the book, and it's about this great creative loss he had in his life. He couldn't find his muse. He went a long time without releasing material, and with battling back and forth between his desire to and his desire not to, and not wanting to force it, but certainly feeling like he had to create something new. He's working on a show, like a musical about him and Yoko. He's working on just books that he's writing and biographies. It sounds like he's got a little bit of everything, and he just can't find what he really wants to do. And as I'm reading all of that, I'm thinking, how much was left behind, and how much did we not get, or did we never get, maybe that he left behind? We have to take a quick break. Kenneth Womack is with us. John Lennon, 1980, The Last Days in the Life is the book. Much more next, 720 WGN. Kenneth Womack is with us. His book, John Lennon, 1980, The Last Days in the Life, details, in essence, I would say, Kenneth, the 5 years leading up to the end of his life, and a lot more. You jump back and forth, but you really focus on these years at the Dakota where he lived and where he ended up being murdered. But talk to me a little bit. So we just heard the song Starting Over. That was on the Double Fantasy album, which, as you mentioned, came out just a month or so before he was murdered. And how much had he gained back? Because he had gone through this real lull, this creative lull, where he just couldn't find not just necessarily his voice, because he was, you detail in the book how he's helping other people out. He's helping Ringo, and he's creating little bits of things here and there that became things. It's not like he was completely void of creativity in those years, right? It was just that he couldn't find what he truly wanted to create.
I think that's safe to say. I would add this little bit of color. So I think we should remember that during this period, he is exhausted from that very long immigration fight, which was only settled in October 1975. He had a protracted lawsuit with Morris Levy over Chuck Berry's song. So there were all sorts of issues. There was reconciling with his wife, having a new baby, right? So there were lots of challenges, undoubtedly, in the mix. When it came to his own music, I think what he was concerned about, especially as those years went by and that tension mounted, was putting himself out there again in that world, which had become very competitive, right? You know, you've got Paul McCartney racking up number one hits. You've got Elton John. You've got disco has come on with a vengeance. New wave is coming. You know, there are lots of new artists who creep into the mix since he takes his retirement. And so I think it was a matter of not just coming up with new material, but new material that he felt good enough about. And you mentioned before the break all of those different formats he tried. Isn't it understandable that the one that he ends up coming back to is what he's always been world class at?
It of course, and that album, Double Fantasy, you know, has a decent amount of really incredible songs on it. So it's not like he had completely lost the touch. He certainly, you know, that album leaves you thinking he had so much more to give and would have had so much more. And you know, it's interesting when you mention all these other guys churning out hits. You know, from my limited knowledge of the Beatles, they break up. It's pretty cantankerous. These guys aren't friends anymore. They were pretty good friends, maybe not all together at once, but he saw Paul a decent amount. He was watching Saturday Night Live with Paul when Lorne Michaels made the famous $3,000 offer for them to get back together. And he saw George Harrison a lot, really loved George Harrison. Sounds like a younger brother. And Ringo as the, if George was the younger brother, what was Ringo? Sort of the Dennis the Menace that you feel like you got to take care of and keep an eye on, but he loved him. So they really still had all this love for each other. It's just they couldn't work together anymore for whatever reason, or just maybe felt so spent from what that was, that it's not about you can't anymore. It's that maybe you just don't have the energy to go through that again.
Sure. And, you know, you're right. On the last day of his life, John Lennon says to his last interviewer in a cab ride to the record plant, his last, not the cab, it was in their car, it was the last ride he was going to take to the record plant. He said, when this wonderful interviewer, Dave Sholin, asked him about, you know, how are things with the other Beatles? And he said, stop right there. I love them. They love me. I would do anything for them, and I think they would do anything for me. And they are like families that have their ups and downs. And, of course, he wasn't feeling great about George at that moment, but he had created reconciliation with the others and would have reconciled with George again. There's no doubt about it. They did have one lingering issue, of course, and that is the Apple company of theirs essentially dissolved with the end of their EMI contract at the beginning of 1976. So they were in a period where there was a lot of sorting out to do with financial matters, and that would go on a long time, I believe, until 1989. So, you know, so I think they were doing very well for guys who had this series of lawsuits, you know, that were dangling out there, especially the period when one guy, Paul McCartney, is making far more money for them than, you know, for the Beatles Incorporated, or what do you want to call it, than the other three.
Was money, because we think about the Beatles as being uber rich. At the time, was money a concern at all? I mean, you know, John's living a pretty extravagant lifestyle. He's not feeling any need to put out more albums or anything right now. It can really be about what he wants to do. Paul laments that John did it, you know, while John is missing the creativity and what he maybe he's missing in some ways, being forced to create because now he doesn't have to, and so he's struggling with letting it come. Paul's still on, you know, on that merry-go-round and creating and touring and doing all those things. Was that part of kind of the issue for John, maybe, that he didn't have the pressure to create?
I'm sure he liked to talk about the fact that he didn't have a contract and that pressure wasn't there. He wasn't trying to meet a deadline for an agent or a record company. I do believe at that point they have reached a certain level of comfort, because while they all were very upset at Paul for suing for the dissolution of the partnership, which ends at the tail end of 1974, what he did do was free up the litigation, at least for a time, which allowed them to start getting paid and moving some of this money around. So that was a good thing.
And I guess my original question was, and I lost myself in there, and I went over to the creativity part. But you know, you talk about freeing up the money. Did they have money issues, or weren't they all just bathing in money?
I don't know if they were bathing in money. I mean, Lennon and McCartney. Lennon was certainly well off, particularly as the 70s ticked by, because, you know, Yoko had become a very shrewd investor. She was investing in real estate. McCartney is obviously doing very well. You know, he's had a huge world tour and won, you know, several number one albums. You know, he's doing quite well. In fact, in either at the beginning of 78 or the beginning of 79, he got a $20 million, you know, contract cash payment from Columbia. So he's doing quite well. You know, the Harrison and Starr had their ups and downs, certainly, but it was a far cry from 1969, when George Harrison used to talk to their accountants and they would say things like, "You're millionaires." And George would say, "Oh, well, that's wonderful. May I see it?" You know, and well, they'd say, "Well, we can't show it to you," you know. And so there was always this kind of doubting of their accountants and their ability to really ascertain the true nature of their wealth. But, you know, as time has demonstrated, it was considerable.
Tell me a little bit about, because you talk about that Paul McCartney's making hits and he's touring, and while Lennon is friendly with all of them, he is jealous, though, isn't he, that Paul is having this success? You mentioned that when he hears a good song on the radio, he will get mad that he didn't create that wasn't part of him. And he certainly had this love-hate relationship with Bob Dylan, didn't he?
He absolutely did. And, you know, I'm glad you brought that up because there's a very subtle distinction that we need to make there. It's less about jealousy and more about, even though it comes off as being about jealousy, and it's more about this kind of self-laceration. So, you know, he famously had a song called How Do You Sleep in 1971 that was about McCartney. And, you know, when he finally apologizes to Paul, he said, you know, that was really just about me and my disappointment in me. And I think we could say the same thing about what he does there in late 1979 when he's making fun of Bob Dylan's new hit, Gotta Serve Somebody, and his song is Serve Yourself. You know, John was reaching out and attacking Dylan, but it was really, I don't know this necessarily makes Dylan or McCartney feel better, but it was really this kind of self-excoriation where he was unhappy with his own progress, his own contributions.
I know it's unfair to do, but when I look at Paul McCartney after the Beatles, and there are big hits, Band on the Run and Silly Little Love Song, and of course the Christmas tune, but I don't, like John Lennon's solo was probably some of his most masterful work. Would we say that about McCartney?
You know, I find something to like in all their solo work, but I think, and I would include George Martin, their producer, in this, when they all step away from Beatles, they're not as good. I do believe John Lennon has, you know, many, many indispensable songs. So does McCartney. But I don't see the achievement in the same way. Now, I think you can look very closely to the moment of the breakup, and you see a lot of great songs that, in many ways, could have been Beatles songs. Paul McCartney, I think his greatest moment is probably Maybe I'm Amazed, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean,
true.
That is a talent song. John Lennon's is probably... Imagine, maybe.
Yeah, it's gotta
be. These are towering songs. Even though it had its own fair share of litigation, My Sweet Lord from George Harrison.
Yeah.
You know, Ringo working with George on the song It Don't Come Easy. Yeah, there were a lot of really fine Beatlesque works coming out.
Hold on one second, Kenneth. Hold on just one second. We got to take a quick break for the news. The book is John Lennon, 1980, The Last Days in the Life. More to come about John Lennon right after the news here on 720 WGN. 837, 720 WGN. It's chilling to hear Howard Cosell do that call even now. But it's funny to hear the Howard Cosell trademark delivery on that. It would be very different, yeah. I think, today from any, in modern days, we hear Bob Costas doing that. But Howard Cosell may be the most famous of all the Beatles. I mean, he's giving it that Howard Cosell treatment, no matter what the story is. We will get to that part of the story here in just a little bit. But you were talking a little bit about Bob Dylan and everybody else and kind of the burning desire to still create and still be that person. As much as Lennon didn't want to be John Lennon anymore of the Beatles, he still wanted to create and still resonate, didn't he?
Absolutely. He would, if pressed, he would admit that, you know, he will never stop making music. And, for all intents and purposes, he never really does. As you know from reading about those 5 years that lead up to the, you know, that incredible comeback. And by the way, your Howard Cosell is pretty good.
Thank you.
I'm just telling.
You don't get much chance to do it anymore, you know?
Well, you nailed it. Yeah, it used to be something we all did at school, kids, right?
Yeah, totally. But
I think we need to think back about how remarkably competitive it was in the late 1970s. You know, go back and look at the chart. It is frightening. If you're somebody trying to make it and get your piece, even if you're one of the folks we now call dinosaurs, right? They're, you know, McCartney and Wings, who are enormous in the 70s, they're fortunate if they have 1 or 2 weeks at number one. That's how much great material was out there.
Yeah.
So John has been feeling that stress.
Yeah. So you go through the book, a lot of John's life and what he's doing in and out and his raising of the son and the relationship with Yoko. You intersperse it a lot with their life at the Dakota, the famous landmark building in New York City, and you give the history of the Dakota and how it came to be. And it's got a very, very interesting backstory in and of itself. But throughout the book, you're going back and forth with the fame. And now even in New York City, which it sounds like John loved so much because he could, this is the most the only place where he could truly sort of just be John Lennon, walking the streets, walking in the park, taking his son to the Y for swimming lessons. He was able to get away with that somewhat, but there was still always somebody recognizing him. And you have so many stories, not just of people hanging around outside. And we know that people do that when there's famous people. And we know that finally is what happened the night he died, is people hanging around and people getting to him. But it's amazing, the stories, not just of people hanging around trying to get a glimpse of John Lennon, people trying to get into the apartment, get into the building to see John Lennon. There's a lot of those stories.
There are, and it was quite profuse, and it annoyed the other neighbors, especially Lauren Bacall, who did not like all of those young people hanging out front, you know, as people were trying to come and go from the famous archway. So, you know, some of the other residents took it personally. Many of the other residents just loved the fact that John Lennon was there. Leonard Bernstein was a huge Beatles and Lennon fan, so, you know, for him, it was probably a treat. John does have this kind of restless relationship with his fame. There's just no doubt about it. And trying to understand, you know, how to be whom he wants to be, and juggle the fact that he's going to walk outside, and there every day there will be somebody, perhaps the same people, perhaps different people, and it will be difficult for him to have that kind of freedom, real freedom.
There's a number of stories in the book of people getting into the apartment, guys who pretended to be repairmen who happened to be let in because they do have a broken VCR, or probably wasn't a VCR then, I imagine a Beta machine, whatever. They had something, and so they get in the apartment, and then they get brought back for a second appointment, and they come. But one story that caught my eye was a couple of kids who got to the apartment, and John answers the door, and they basically say, oh my gosh. And he comes in and he starts answering questions for them and seems pretty cool with it until they say, can we come back again tomorrow? And then he makes his assistant get them the heck out of there. And as I was reading that, I'm thinking he's like Willy Wonka at this point, isn't he?
I believe that's kind of true, you know, and there is that mystique that exists anyway about the Beatles because people so badly want them to get back together, right? And so there is this level of mystique. You know, he just absolutely struggled with that. He often, though, as you know, was not concerned about his own safety. That the big fear during that period was not that they would hurt the celebrity or the celebrity's husband or wife. It was that they would kidnap the children. And the 70s are the great age of kidnappings and hijackings. You know, so really the preparation that was made in those days was to help people who were likely to find themselves in those situations.
Which they surprisingly didn't do enough preparing for, right? You mentioned that there was a piece in a gossip column about how they fortified everything in the Dakota with all these extra locks and deadbolts and things. And their assistants like, we had one deadbolt on the door like anybody else did. Any, you know, people could have gotten through here if they got past the doorman. And they were afraid for their son. And it's interesting that they maybe didn't do more, but John wrestled with that, right? Because he did feel like, this goes against everything I'm saying. I'm a pacifist, and now I'm going to have somebody who's going to lay down their life for me. I can't do that. At the same time, of course, he wants to protect his child, and they had a terrible scare, probably the worst kind of scare, wasn't it? Because they had a threat that then they never found out what happened, right? The whoever threatened them sort of disappeared and never reemerged, and that has to be in some ways the worst possible thing because it leaves you forever looking over your shoulder, doesn't it?
So you have no fruition, you know, you don't know how it all sorted out. John's line that he repeated many, many times is, I could have bodyguards, but they're going to kill the bodyguard first, and then they're going to kill me anyway, and I'll have that on my everlasting conscience for all time, you know. So he would kind of make a joke out of it. But, you know, one of the things that I really enjoyed doing and was one of my chief strategies for this book was to be able to take people back to New York in 1980, because it's not the same place we know now, just as Chicago, right, is not the same place at all downtown that it was then. These are very different places, and I felt like getting that flavor, even a little bit of the danger, was important in the kind of grimy dirtiness that existed, so people can understand just how different it was. And one of the other ways it was different, of course, is we all thought differently about the world. You know, people still left their doors unlocked somewhere, right? People still left the keys in the car. They couldn't imagine some of these things happening. What did Howard say? You know, an unspeakable tragedy, yeah. Right? You know, it is an unspeakable tragedy, but we saw many more in the years since then. So it just reminds us how much different the world was and how much smaller it was.
Let's talk about Yoko for another moment. You mentioned her business acumen. I got to a part in the book where you're talking about their shopping, and I'm laughing thinking, boy, thank God they weren't around. I mean, I know Yoko is, but could you imagine them in the days of Amazon and online shopping? They probably would have bankrupted themselves, it sounds like, the way they shopped. But not only did John have the money, of course, from the Beatles, but as you mentioned, she was buying property. She was making investments, I think, in cows. Like, she's really a business, and she was tending to all their Beatles affairs, wasn't she?
She was, and that was very important for John, and was frankly a great gift to him from her, because that also exhausted him in the late 60s and early 70s, and it wasn't his strong suit, and she discovered that it was hers, and she made many shrewd investments. I mean, by the time of his death, he was worth north of $200 million. Which is a far cry from where he started in the 70s. So, they had made very shrewd investments. Now, of course, the Beatles sold a lot of records in the 60s and the 70s, and they were able to clear up a lot of their fiscal matters and get that money distributed. But, yeah, she made quite a contribution. She also helped him get his confidence back, bought him the electric piano and recording devices and other things so that he could work at his leisure, and slowly but surely he got there.
We're speaking with Kenneth Womack. The book is called John Lennon, 1980, The Last Days in the Life. Let's take one more quick break, and then let's get to those last days next on 720 WGN. 850 on 720 WGN. A few more minutes with our friend Kenneth Womack. He's the author of John Lennon, 1980, The Last Days in the Life. So, Kenneth, we've been talking quite a bit about this period he went through of real struggle and personal introspection and a lot of work on a lot of different mediums. How does it finally come together? How does he find it to start making Double Fantasy?
I do think that the Dylan song we talked about earlier, the one that he wrote in response to Dylan called Serve Yourself, that really seemed to make quite a difference to him in turning the tide, as it were, because after that he settles down and he continues working on Watching the Wheels. He decides that he has the confidence at this point to write a song for his son, Beautiful Boy, Darling Boy. So I do think that was the turning point. And then as he works through the spring, he finally arrives in Bermuda and he finishes up a lot of material while writing a few more songs. So he really does find, you know, like a poet, really. He begins to find that inspiration and he starts to ride it.
and so the album gets finished. Is it a very difficult process? And what was the reaction to them making this album together and going back and forth on the tracks? I know the Lennon tracks. I know the famous songs from it. I don't know the Yoko songs. Did everybody just, was there, because he was at a point, it sounds like, where he wasn't going to listen to any outside pressure. So was he just doing what he wanted to do? And was there any talk of, hey, maybe two separate albums, you shouldn't do this with Yoko? Was there any pressure on him to not work with her in that way?
Sure. And, you know, going back to the first part of that question, one of the things that really made the end of that summer so special was they were working with producer Jack Douglas, and Jack hired an arranger, Tony DeVillio, who really did just a fine job in arranging those songs in advance so that the band that they'd put together could learn them. And then by the time John and Yoko came in the studio, they were just flying. And then, of course, that's when the magic happens, when the band already knows the song, right? So a lot of smart moves were made by Jack. They did toy with how to present the album, you know, one side each, you know, would you alternate songs? How would we play this, right? So ultimately, they come down with a kind of conversation. They called it a heart play, where they would be speaking back and forth to one another. And if you study those lyrics, it actually works out quite well, you know, in terms of how this discussion is going on. And it reveals parts of their personalities. As far as the Yoko songs, I mean, there are a number of them that did very well at the time with critics. Kiss, 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 especially Every Man Has a Woman Who Loves Him, I'm Moving On. She had a kind of new wave sound, so she sounded very au courant. And in at least the initial review, she seemed to be getting a slightly better press. Now, again, a lot of the major reviews had not come out yet, and it had only been 3 weeks since the, you know, since the record was really widely available.
But, so, you know, in today's
it was quite early days.
In today's
and
day,
then of course, one.
Well, Kenneth, in today's day and age, you know, a release is immediate and it's got to be huge, like a movie or a thing. And there was really a slow build, and who knows how slow it would have been had he not met his tragic demise, because that made everything skyrocket real fast. But this was not on its way to being a huge hit. It was, you know, even though in retrospect, there's some really good music here that you would think would have taken off right away. But it really was moving slow at first, wasn't it?
It was moving slow by their standards. So it opened, I believe, at 25 or 26, which is very respectable. And it was set to be, before he was murdered, number 8. So he had a top 10 album and the single, and I believe they'd already sold enough for a gold record before he was murdered. So it was doing the things you wanted it to do. But let's go back to 1980 again. With all that competition, bands had to figure out ways to set them apart. This is still a few years from the really mainstreaming, right, of all those videos in the MTV era, even though they did exist. And so what they would often do is it was your big tour that made a difference, right? So, you know, Paul McCartney, his album was what came in at number 7 in 1979, Back to the Egg. And so when he gets to the end of that year, he goes on tour and would have gone on a longer tour if not for his little arrest in Japan, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, I think if Lennon had indeed toured in 1981, which, you know, by all intents he was going to, he would have seen some real dividends from that, because that's when people say, oh, I'm going to the Lennon Ono concert in February. Let's buy that thing, yeah. You know, so...
Yeah.
I think it would have had a slow burn. Another thing that I can't stop thinking about when we talk about the what ifs of that period, you know, on December 8th, they had taken a very, you know, even still controversial photo of John naked wrapped around Yoko, remember, mm-hmm. for the Rolling Stone cover. And of course, when we first saw that, we were already in mourning. So it didn't have any effect other than to say, wow, he's gone. That guy's not here anymore. You know, instead of the kind of salacious headlines he would have enjoyed when that issue of Rolling Stone came out, and that would have sold a lot of copies too. You know,
yeah.
There was a reason why he'd be on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Kenneth Womack, we're out of time. I got to get to the news. It's a great book. It's a great read. I'm going to enjoy the rest of it. It's called John Lennon, 1980, The Last Days in the Life. Thank you for all the research on it. Thanks for bringing these stories to life and for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you. And good to hear from you and all my friends in Chicago.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Get the book. Order it online. Visit an actual local bookstore. John Lennon, 1980. Kenneth Womack, thank you so much.